I'm delighted to find Mary Chandler in the village, and she and I have done some work together before, and it's obvious that what we're doing has a lot of complementarity. So how many here have been listening to her Bible studies in the morning? So quite a few. Okay, great. What I'll be doing this week is working on God language and gender, and moving from some theological questions and discussions about some of the theological issues involved in that to some actual writing of prayers and poems. Those don't have to be long prayers and poems. They could be two or three lines, but hopefully toward the end of the week, Thursday and Friday, I can persuade some of you as you're walking in the woods or sitting in the sauna or the jacuzzi or whatever to start engaging in deep thoughts about the God language that would be liberating and affirmative for you and that would really open up an affirmation of relationship to God that would be inclusive. And by inclusive, I don't necessarily mean some particular stereotypic female imagery or even neutral generic imagery, but some kind of language that might transcend traditional patriarchal image for God. So I'm planning to work from some discussion of the theological issues to opening up the possibility of people actually working with their own imagery, developing them in something you might want to call a prayer, or if you don't feel comfortable with that, you might want to call it a poem. share some of that in the last couple of sessions. So that's where I hope to go, as I said, from working with some of the theological questions to some actual work with your own imagery and writing. Okay, the focus for this afternoon is the whole question, as I see it, of the social function of God language. And I'd like to start out by contending or making it as a statement of my own conviction that God language is always social and political, which is to simply to say that we are always social and political, and that our God language basically reflects our human experience and situation as people who are always social and political. That is to say, we exist as persons who are embedded in social political communities. And so even when we appear to be alone or private or an individual, we are nevertheless within social political communities. We are in one way or another taking up a stance in relationship to society and, of course, within society. So I want to start out in this way to critique what I see as a myth of individualism. Now, a myth of individualism is different from saying that we have personal being, that we are persons. But I think to say that we are persons is different from the notion of an individual, because the notion of individualism really suggests that individuals can be seen as existing prior to society, outside of society, apart from society, and can be considered without relationship to society. And I would say that we are, in our very being, shaped as persons within a matrix of social existence. And this means, it seems to me, that all God language has a social political function. That is to say, it takes up a stance in relationship to the social order. And that means that it either ratifies the social order by naming the social order as a social order which God created, which God wills, which God blesses, which God wishes to promote and reinforce and perpetuate, and most of all, which God wishes to enjoin obedience or compliance with. In other words, that the way we name God either suggests that God has that kind of relationship to the social order. God created it, and he surely wants you to comply with it. Or else our God language, in one way or another, subverts it, subverts the social order. The word subvert means to sort of turn around from below. Subverts it. Another word is God judges it. Our God language questions it or calls it in some way to an alternative standard of justice. In other words, that our God language either ratifies the social order or in one way or another calls it to change. Calls it to change precisely in order to be more in accordance or obedience with God and God's will. So what I'm suggesting here as my primary premise or foundational premise is that there is no politically, socially neutral God language. Even if the social message of our God language may be veiled or maybe indirect, it's always there in one way or another, either ratifying the existing social system or in some way questioning it. Now, this also suggests for me that God language is always problematic when it uncritically sacralizes or sanctifies any actual existing social system. Now, that's a little bit different from saying democracy, let's say, as an ideal, because democracy, in fact, very imperfectly exists in any society that calls itself democratic. So it's possible to say that our God language might promote a certain social ideal, but that's somewhat different from simply saying that our God language ratifies an existing order as it is. And this is the case because obviously all existing social orders, all existing human constructs of society are partly unjust. I don't say that they're totally unjust. I'm not saying that all social systems are totally evil. I'm saying that they are always partly unjust, partly sinful, and they reflect a human sinfulness precisely to the extent that some groups have disproportionate power and gain disproportionate wealth and status through a particular kind of social arrangements. That one of the sinful aspects of society is that they're structured in unequal ways, so that some people, not necessarily because of any particular virtue, but simply because they belong to certain groups, have disproportionate status and wealth and disproportionate power, and that this disproportionate power, status, and wealth is possible precisely because other people have disproportionate dependency and are in an exploitative relationship. Now, what I mean by an exploitative relationship is that the power, wealth, and status of one group is purchased by rendering another group inferior, making them do perhaps a great deal of the labor, but getting very little of the wealth out of that. In other words, that their work is partly a source of wealth for ruling elites, but that these inferiorized or marginalized people, even though they may contribute a great deal of the work to society, are demeaned in status, slavery being the most obvious example. They are demeaned in status. They are regarded as inferior, both in terms of the work they do and often simply in terms of their actual social group that they belong to. This isn't necessarily even based on racism, although our society has been particularly familiar with arranging things in terms of racial hierarchy. So these other groups are regarded as in some way innately inferior, and the status that they have in society is set up in such a way as to deprive them not only of equal resources, but often to deprive them of even the adequate basic human needs in terms of food and shelter, education, medical aid, safe affirming communities, and education. So those kind of societies, which have in fact been any human society of which I've been acquainted, have had that kind of sinful pattern. Now, how does God language ratify that kind of sinful pattern of injustice? Basically, it seems to me God language has functioned to ratify that kind of sinful structure of injustice by suggesting that that kind of pattern of society has been created by God. That its laws have been given by God, that it reflects God's will. To put it in a nutshell, that this society reflects God's order of creation. Remember that one? In other words, to assume that societies of male over female, or of class hierarchy, or of race hierarchy, and so on, that these reflect the order of creation. That's a theological way of saying God wanted them that way, and so they are that way because that's the way God reflected, intended them. So the social system is rooted in an order of creation. God language also, of course, ratifies such unjust systems by naming God after the elites of such social systems. Which is to say that the social elites, God is given the same name as these particular social elites, and is in fact made to look very much like these social elites. So what you're really saying when you call God after these social elites and make God sort of, you know, picture gods after the model of these kind of social elites, you're really saying that these social elites are in the image of God. They are, in fact, the primary or normative bearers of the image of God. They are really the representatives of God on earth, and to obey them is to obey God. And obviously, the contrary is also true. To disobey them is to disobey God. To seek to change such systems is to rebel against God. So that has been one classic way of using God language to ratify particular unjust social systems. In other words, by imaging God as a patriarchal father, and I want to make clear that a patriarchal father is not a good father, and I'll be talking later in the week about the difference between Abbas and patriarchal fathers. But let's start out by saying to image God after a patriarchal father, to image God after a military leader, and to image God after monarch, emperor, or other such aristocratic elites. All of that is to say that a military elite, an aristocratic elite, a patriarchal elite, that these groups are the godlike ones. They look like God, God looks like them. They are wonderfully similar. In all ways, and obviously the people who do not belong to these elites are unsimilar to God, which is that they do not have the image of God in the same way as these elites. So it seems to me that this is a very basic way in which God language ratifies unjust orders, is precisely by imaging God after the leaders of these groups, making them appear to be God's representatives. In obedience to God being comparable to obedience to these groups. Now I'd like to kind of unpack some aspects of that, let's say some aspects of imaging God after a patriarchal father, warrior, and king. One aspect, which perhaps we are more familiar with, from the feminist critique is that this makes God to be essentially, or in some way, normatively male. Now, I want to go on and say that maleness is a part of the problem, but it's not the whole problem, but it is a part of it. So I'll talk a little bit about that. Because certainly that's a very big part of what the contemporary churches are talking about when they talk about inclusive language, is to suggest this dangerous thought that maybe God isn't actually male, or maleness isn't actually more like God than femaleness. What is suggested when you sort of insist that God has to be imaged in terms of male imagery is that males are more like God than females, that males are the normative image of God. And therefore, in some way, God should only be imaged as a male. And we have to see the interconnection between the notion of image of God and our images of God. If we say that particular social groups, females in this case, cannot be images of, we can't image God after femaleness, then we are really saying that females don't have the image of God. But you really can't say both things. I mean, you can't say that women are in the image of God and then say that God can't be imaged as a female. Is that clear what I'm saying? If you say God can't be imaged as a female, you're really saying that women don't have the image of God. And when we look at the classical Christian theological tradition, specifically Augustine, and a whole tradition that flows out of Augustine, what we find is exactly this is what was said. Augustine says in his treatise on the Trinity that the male possesses the image of God normatively, that he really is the one who has the image of God, and that women possess the image of God only when they are taken together with the male who is their head. Do you get what's being said? What you're really saying is that women actually don't have any head. They are kind of tucked in here under the man's armpit. And they are related to God through the male who is their head. And he goes on to make that very explicit. He says that women relate to the image of God only through the male who is in their head. But in themselves, they do not possess the image of God. But the male possesses the image of God whether or not he is in relationship to the female. This is not a reciprocal relationship. It's important to look at that statement in Augustine, and then there's a whole theological tradition which has flowed out of that. Now, obviously, very different from what has come to be our assumption of the exegesis of Genesis 1, the image of God, male and female, which we assume means that male and female is in the image of God. But we have to remember that the Christian tradition from Augustine until fairly recently did not read it that way, but read the male as having the normative image of God, and women as having it only through the male who is their head. Now, when we start unpacking that statement, we discover that underlying that are a whole series of assumptions. First of all, there's an assumption about headship, which is really the assumption about who has the power to rule and to be rational. In other words, sovereignty and reason were assumed to be essentially male qualities, and they were also assumed to be essentially godlike qualities. Because God represents sovereignty, rule over others, and rationality. And men have this, and women don't. Or don't have it in a way that's... Well, they certainly don't have sovereignty in this tradition. They don't rule over anyone. Except maybe in conjunction with their husband toward children. But in any case, sovereignty and reason are assumed to be normatively male and also normatively the roles of God. And so this is a very important aspect of why it was assumed that the image of God was essentially male, and that women, therefore, do not image God because they can't image this normative role of leadership and rationality. But they are the image of what? I want to guess what they're the image of. They are the image of the body. So as they image what is to be ruled over. And so what you really have underlying this is a fundamental paradigm of male to female as ruler to ruled, as God to creature. In other words, God to creature, ruler to ruled, male to female is the basic underlying assumption here. And that God represents, of course, the ultimate rationality and sovereignty, and males exercise this, and females cannot exercise it, and they essentially represent that which is to be ruled over. They symbolize the creaturely, they symbolize that which is to be ruled over, but they cannot represent that which rules, and was the godlike function. So that was a very essential presupposition of that traditional notion about God images as normatively male. I think it's also important to look at the concept of the patriarchal father in antiquity. Because the patriarchal father, in many ways, our God language has been modeled on ancient patriarchy, but most of us have forgotten what patriarchy means. Patriarchy is more than sexism. And it really refers to a whole social order, a whole legal social order, of which we have some remnants still today, but of which has been in many ways changed. A very important aspect to remember about the ancient patriarchal social order is that the pater familias, the father of the family, was not in Roman law regarded as a member of the family. Do we hear that? The father is not a member of the family. Why? Because he rules over the family. The familia, the word familia, from which we get the word family, in Roman law represents those who are subjects to the father as ruler. They are wife, concubine, children, male and female, before they become autonomous. But of course, women never really become autonomous in the patriarchal system. Slaves, cattle, and property. So the familia represents persons and things ruled over by the pater familias. And the pater familias is then seen as the ruler over a whole community of persons and things who are under his power. They are subjects to him. And that legal structure in the family was in turn seen as the norm for the society. It was the whole social order. This was the basic cell upon which the whole patriarchal social order was constructed. So that only pater familias, heads of family, then in fact were allowed to be the political decision-making group of the society. And the king, in relation to society, represented the pater familias writ large. So we have to kind of look at that social structure with its subject, wives, children, and slaves, cattle and property, and see that in the patriarchal social order as a kind of nucleus out of which a whole social order was modeled. It was all the assumptions about that men only could play political roles, that women could not, and so on, are based on that kind of social structure writ large. So when we look at a lot of our God language, we see that it has been modeled after a social order that we have carried along in our imagery, but we, to a certain extent, no longer understand or hopefully don't no longer fully accept. Because most of us carry along a lot of quite different presuppositions, like partnership marriage and things like that, which were really not a part of the assumptions of the patriarchal family. So I suggest that we look at our God language to see how much it still reflects that pattern, how much, for example, imaging God as a patriarchal father then assumes that you image Israel, the church, the human community as what? You image them after the subjects of the pater familias. You image the church or Israel as God's wife, God's sons, and God's servants. It was the three subject groups. Daughters, of course, are invisible in this system. The three subject groups to the father are his wife, his sons, and his servants. And so that we have taken a basic model of God and Israel, God and church. And we've used the pater familias language for God, and we use the subjects, wives, children, wives, sons, or children, and servants or slaves for the community. And so that language continues to carry over those presuppositions. You get, of course, in the household codes of the New Testament, an effort to kind of reestablish that pattern over against some early Christian challenges to it. So you have reiterated in the household codes, wives obey your husbands, slaves obey your masters, children obey your parents, which is an effort to reaffirm that pattern for the Christian church. So I'm suggesting here that we have modeled God and also the church after a particular kind of social order. I think this also suggests a couple of other things that we need to consider. I think that this kind of pattern, particularly as it flowed into Greek philosophical thinking, tended also to reinforce a kind of dualism of spirit and body. That God is thought of as that which is disembodied. There was a kind of disembodied sovereignty, disembodied power, rationality, sort of up there outside of the body. And then bodiliness becomes the image of that which is to be ruled over, that which God created and is subject to God. And so women, of course, come to be the images of bodiliness as well as non-human nature as the image of the bodiliness. And I think that also suggests that we come closer to God by turning away from relationship to other people, by turning away from nature, by turning away from our bodies. That all these things are distractions from God, and God is not present in these things. And so you kind of get to God by kind of mentally disaffiliating with him, sort of body stuff or relationships. I think that that certainly has been one of the implications of a certain kind of spirituality. I think another aspect is to image God after a certain pattern of ruling. And I would suggest that one pattern of ruling that has been very typical and which has been reflected in a lot of our God language is God as ruling by might and mercy. Now, you might be willing to have some questions about might. Probably most of you think mercy is a pretty good thing. I'd like to suggest some problems with both might and mercy, and particularly when they come as a package deal. The might part of it suggests that God rules essentially by coercion, that God is a wrathful God, and God essentially is a punishing God, that God's sort of going after sinners and punishing them for their evil deeds. And so one of the basic images of God is that of the wrathful punishing ruler who is coercively punishing his enemies. But then the other side of that is to assume if we want to be in relationship to God, we have to start out by assuming that we are, in fact, worthless, that we are sinners who have really merit nothing but this punishing, wrathful response of God. And it is only through God's complete forbearance and mercy that we are related to God and that we really have no goodness in ourselves at all. I suggest that this kind of language of us as worthless is a flat-out denial of creation. it's a Manichaean kind of language, although certainly one can occasionally use that language to talk about our extreme alienation from God, one should never do it in a way that denies that underneath any alienation we are nevertheless created by God, and God creates no trash. So to talk sort of in an unequivocal way about us being worthless is really, I think, to deny the fundamental truth of Genesis, that God created it and it was very good. But I think, in addition to that, it promotes a fundamental passivity. We can't do anything, so we have to just wait upon God. Again, there's always kind of partial truths in waiting, ideas of waiting upon God, but when it becomes a kind of total message, I think it promotes a kind of passivity. Passivity both in relationship to God and in relationship to sort of doing anything about injustice in the world. You know, God's going to take care of it, we can't, and so on. A sort of passive acquiescence to unjust power, either assuming that they represent God or that God will take care of them if they don't. So I think there's a kind of irresponsibility that it has been fostered by Christianity, by this language of passive acquiescence and thinking of ourselves as unable to do anything and God's going to take care of it. I think some of our worst political behavior comes right out of this God language. Ronald Reagan basically thinks he's God. In a perfectly humble sense, I mean, he humbly thinks that he represents God, and he must punish God's enemies, and he knows who they are. Nicaraguans and Libyans, probably Russians too, but so he feels that he has, you see, the key to Ronald Reagan that makes him so dangerous is that he's sincere. See, he there's no gap in his mind between myth and reality. So he thinks that, that he... There's no gap. Between fiction and reality, in that kind of a celluloid view of the world, and so that he really, I think, he thinks quite sincerely that he is punishing God's enemies when he wants money for the Contras or bombs the Libyan, and then on the other hand, of course, he rewards those who are compliant to American power because he knows that we represent God on earth, and those who are compliant to us are compliant to God. So I think we need to unpack some of that kind of wrath and compliance language that we foster and see what it would really mean when translated into human political behavior. What I'm trying to do here is show you how certain kind of God language needs to be looked at in terms of its latent or overt political and social messages, and what kind of relationship to power, earthly power, certain kinds of God language suggest. I'd like to then go on and talk a little bit about the post-Christian feminist critique of patriarchal God language, and to say, try to unpack it a little bit. I don't know how many of you have been aware of writers like Starhawk, A Spiral Dance. It's probably not being taught in St. Olaf's, but college. But if you were at Berkeley, you would be aware of it. But there is essentially a whole post-Christian feminist movement. And by saying post-Christian feminist movement, I'm also indicating that there are also something called Christian feminists who don't fully agree with this view, and I happen to be one of them. But I think that they're saying some things that we should pay attention to, but we don't have to swallow them whole. One of those writers, and I notice you have a few of these authors in your bookstore here, one of them is Starhawk. Who is a Jewish witch. Both of those are good words in her sense. This is her coven name, Starbuck, her Jewish name is Miriam Seamus, and she sees herself as reviving an ancient religion of the great goddess, and she wrote a book called The Spiral Man, which is a kind of a book of prayer in a way. And then she's written another book, which I noticed was in your bookstore, called Dreaming in the Dark. There are a number of other people writing in this genre. One of them is Carol Chris. I'll just put her name up here. She has a couple of books. Another of them is Judith Goldberg, who's got a book called The Return of the Goddess. Changing of the Gods, yeah. Naomi Goldberg, Judith Foster, and Carol Chris were all buddies together, so I couldn't see them together. Changing of
Mary Daly written anything?
Well, Mary Daly is a post-Christian, but I think of a quite a different genre from these people. So I would put her, shall we say, in a kind of a class by herself, because she really doesn't do the same thing that these folks are. Basically, what this group is saying is that the biblical God, and specifically the literature that started with the Old Testament and has flowed on into Christianity as well as Islam, that this whole patriarchal monotheism arose as a religious expression of a political social movement. And this social political movement of patriarchy arose somewhere in second or first millennium BC and overthrew an earlier society. And this earlier society they would see as, if not matriarchal, at least matricentral, female-centered society, which was peace-loving, which was caring of the earth, where there was equality between humans, and that goddess religion essentially represented this earlier peaceful and egalitarian social order, and that patriarchy arose as a kind of historical coup that overthrew the goddess, basically overthrew the old social order and substituted for it a militaristic order, one based on class hierarchy, on male domination, and so on. And that, therefore, that feminism, that women, and ultimately both women and men, if they happen to be inclusive, and most of these people are not separatists, by the way, and that would make them somewhat different from Mary Daly. Most of them are very interested in a new society for women and men. This is certainly true of Starhawk. In other words, you should not confuse these folks with separatists, necessarily, because they're not. They would say that in order to have a new society fully affirming of women and mutuality between women and men, we really have to abandon this biblical tradition that its whole basic message is that of violence, domination, and male power, and that there's just no way to redeem it. And so we have to really create a whole new spirituality, a whole new theology for a new social order, which will, they would see in some way as restoring or reviving the ancient social order of the goddess. Now, I'd like to unpack a little bit of that. There's some obvious questions about that, and I would say there are three obvious questions one needs to ask. First of all, was there ever such a good society? We're always peaceful, happy, and just. Secondly, did ancient goddess religions, and we know a number of ancient religions that had goddesses. I actually don't know of any religion that was just a goddess religion. Most religions that have goddesses are basically systems that have male and female deities. But I'll talk about that later. But in any case, can we look to ancient religions that had goddesses as expressions of those of that good, peaceful, happy society? And then thirdly, does biblical religion only express the sanctification of male domination in a system of dominating power and violence. Now, I would say that there's some things that I agree with and some things I don't agree with in this story. I have not seen any evidence that once upon a time there was a peaceful, loving, happy, just society where everybody cared for the earth and loved each other and so on. And so I think at this point, my goddess friends have confused the Garden of Eden with prehistory. I mean, I think quite uncritically. I mean, I don't see that they see, I think they want very much to think that such a society once existed. And they want to believe that that actually existed as a kind of norm back there. But I would see this as a mythological idea, which has been confused with prehistory. Prehistory in the literal sense. I heard Carol Chris give a talk in which she said that she would accept the fact that the good matriarchal society had been partially overthrown even with the beginning of historical civilizations like Sumer. And so that ancient historical paganism didn't represent this good, happy society. But before that, you know, before history began at Sumer, there was such a society. It was back to the Neolithic age. I haven't discovered, it's pretty hard to find out what was going on prehistory anyway. But I haven't discovered from anything I've seen that there was a peaceful, happy, just society before history began at Sumer. Nor am I convinced that goddesses automatically represent an overall more just society. I think they do often represent more parity between men and women, but more parity between men and women can exist in a highly class stratified society. You understand what I mean? Now, as you can have kings and queens, you can have more parity between men and women within a framework of extreme injustice between social classes. So it may be that societies of gods and goddesses may at times represent more gender parity, but not necessarily an overall more just society. Needless to say, am I convinced that biblical monotheism only represents patriarchal dominance and violence, although it may represent some of that. But I would also believe that there are some positive, liberating things that we can reclaim, and that's what I obviously want to discuss as we go through the week, are the positive, liberating things that we need to reclaim. So what I would like to suggest is the important thing about the message of these people is not what they tell us about ancient times. It was whether what they say about ancient times are true or not is really, in a certain sense, irrelevant. The importance of their message is really for today. In other words, I think that we should see them as representing a kind of cry of distress that comes not as a literal expression of some ancient religion that existed in the Neolithic age, but really represents a generation of people post-Hiroshima. And that the consciousness they represent really represents a group of people that increasingly see a certain kind of mentality of power, violence, destructiveness, alienation, as not only destructive of women, but ultimately endangering the very existence of the planet. And I think the people writing out of this consciousness are really writing that their tales about ancient goddesses are really a kind of mythological way of saying that distressed cry for today. So I think we need to pay attention to them in terms of that message of today. And I think what they are seeing is basically the way in which certain kinds of God language and spirituality has indeed and does indeed function to promote male domination, violence, war, alienation, and so on. And that's really what they're questioning. And on the other hand, they represent a quest for some alternative God language, some alternative spirituality that would promote all kinds of good things. In other words, I think these people's ethics are quite good. And what they want to promote is very much what I want to promote. They want to promote a spirituality that would encourage mutuality between men and women, that would encourage care for the earth, that would encourage a kind of positive relationship of spirituality and embodiedness and so on. Because most of their values are very much, shall we say, Holden Village values. But they have despair to finding this in the Bible, and they're looking for it in some kind of alternative symbolism and religious tradition, which if they can't find in ancient times, they will, of course, create today, because what they are convinced of is that this is what we need. So I'll kind of bring my remarks here to a close at that point, and let people feed in some questions about that. And essentially, I think the key thing I want to explore here is the social function of God language. How our God language promotes perhaps the ratification, unconscious or conscious, of certain kinds of social systems, and how our God language, I think, needs to promote some certain kinds of transformations toward more mutual relationships between genders, between social groups, and obviously between humanity and non-human nature. Yeah?
What was the family structure of the Hebrews?
The family structure of the Hebrews?
It would be not the Romans. I mean, that would be the New Testament, but of the Old Testament.
I think they had a patriarchal family. Although I think you would have to, I'm not a Old Testament scholar, and I think you probably would have to, I mean, the Hebrew community runs through 1,500 years, and it doesn't stay static in 1,500 years. So you have earlier patterns which are polygamous, which assume several wives, and certainly assume that wives, children, and cattle are in some continuity with each other. And then there's more of a promotion of monogamy later on, but still very much with an assumption of women's secondary role and so on. Although you get sometimes a very powerful role of woman as the householder. So that, for example, a lot of the wisdom imagery comes from the role of woman as householder. So, I mean, that's a whole very complicated thing, but I think certainly the overall paradigm is that of a patriarchal family. That's still very much a Jewish issue today. Well, Jewish feminists are still very much struggling with a religious tradition, which until recently, for example, the Orthodox Jewish tradition still today says that a minyan, which is to say the assembly of a synagogue for worship, can only take place if there are 10 male heads of families. The women are not even counted. And that's still the Orthodox tradition. That was changed for the Reformed Church. And then only very recently, the conservatives allowed women to be counted, even for a minyan. So I think it's very clear that there, although there are changes, the basic paradigm of the Jewish family is patriarchal. Because I don't think there's a huge difference between the Roman view of the family and the classical Hebrew one, which was also both societies accepted slaveholding as a normal part of the social structure.
In other words, that was just sort of a classical throughout the world at that period of time.
Well, I don't know that it's throughout the world, because the world included Hawaiians and all kinds of people that might have had different social systems. But in the kind of Mediterranean cultures, and the major Mediterranean cultures, however, I would say that there are remnants of an alternative pattern in the Egyptians, which has a strong traces of a matrilineal society. And there are traces of matrilineal in the Old Testament that may come from Egyptian roots, but I mean, again, that gets into some complex biblical anthropology, which is not my thing.
How about a Deborah as a judge or Miriam then?
Yeah, well, certainly you have some, you have countervening aspects, but that doesn't change an overall patriarchal family paradigm, in which you have the notion of prophets and prophetesses and the your occasional female judge. It's interesting, however, the marginalization, if you look at the three female, main female figures of judges, Miriam, on the one hand, is seen as the one who led Moses, together with Moses and Aaron, led Egypt, the Egyptians out of Egypt. And so there's a moment when she appears almost equal. And then if you look out of the tradition, you find that she gets blasted. And I suggest the blasting of her is a later reflection that comes from saying, this lady's too powerful, we have to kind of marginalize her. And so she gets turned into a leper for what? Questioning Moses. And it's said that she became like one whose father had spit in her face, which is to say, a father in that kind of society. If he spit in his daughter's face, he had disowned her. And you're really saying that God had spit in her face. If you say that God, you know, God turned into a leper, so she became one like as whose father had spit in her face. But there's funny little aspects of that, because it also said that the people refused to move on until she was healed. So that all these stories have to be kind of unpacked for remnants of what I think were struggles over women's status in antiquity. I mean, in the biblical tradition. Deborah, of course, is a great judge, but she's a great judge precisely as a kind of cheering on a military victory. And Huldah, who's the other prophetess, gets her place basically by blasting the goddess out of the temple. So they play, shall we say, specific roles. Any other questions? Yeah?
Explain or tell me exactly where you include in the term God language.
Well, all of our language for God is language. That is to say that God doesn't speak in words. And so we don't have any words for God that come from God, because God doesn't speak in words. Now, I make a point of that because Christians have this stuff about the word of God, and they easily think, therefore, that God speaks in words, and God doesn't speak in words. Words are human artifacts just as much as pictures or anything else. And any word that you could mention obviously will be in one language or another. So if you take any words as coming directly from God, then you get into the problem of saying, what language does God speak? And there are obviously some people who are sure that God speaks Hebrew or English or whatever. So I think we have to be clear that all of our words about God are metaphorical in the sense that they come from human language and they extrapolate out of human words for things that we know from experiences that we know. We somehow use those as ways of pointing beyond what we know to something that we know, don't know directly, which is God. And that would be true also of images in the sense of pictorial images. So if I was talking about God language, I'm talking specifically about verbal symbols for God. One can also, of course, have pictorial symbols of various kinds as well. And then those could be translated into verbal symbols. But I'm specifically talking about verbal images.
Isn't it Mary Daly's position, as I have listened to her, that our language of God is so corrupt and so beyond redemption that anything we try in the area is going to fail? At least I sense that as I listen to her. That somehow a few people had to move into a new era who had to somehow escape
that current. Yeah, well, I think that Mary Daly feels that our entire linguistic system is a product of patriarchy, and therefore all of our words carry these distorted images that ratify evil power of various kinds. And so what she's become is a kind of linguistic deconstructionist, in which she's constantly taking apart words and turning them around to sort of make the word itself reveal an alternative insight.
She said even our gestures are reflect our male
yeah.
dominant.
Yeah, so she would say that all of our images, we talk about the thrust of the argument,
the thrust of things, yes.
And all this kind of thing, so that all of our language, gestures, imagery is loaded by a particular social system. And so, as I said, she's come to focus very much on this kind of deconstruction of language and images, and her books become increasingly written in this Daly-esque language of deconstruction. I understand that she's writing now a dictionary for her books, which is a logical development. I have to tell you just a little footnote about that. I was in Germany in the beginning of June, and Mary Daly was there too, and she was giving some lectures. She doesn't give her lectures in German, she gives them with a translator. And I was thinking to myself, how in the world can you translate, deconstruction punning that really is created based on the English language into German? But what apparently she's discovered is a woman in Germany who has virtually created a whole German to translate Daly. And so this woman who translates Daly serves as her translator when she gives lectures. I wish that I had such a...
She begins in the Roman Catholic tradition and moves to America.
Well, that's a good way to get alienated, I would say. Some of us are stubborn, however. Yes?
I know you're going to talk later on in the week about as you said, that some of the themes and strains that can be reclaimed out of uh-huh. images. But I'm curious in knowing what you think. How did those more wholesome strains get there in the biblical tradition?
Well, I would say they get there very simply because the biblical tradition is not, in fact, just about ratifying male patriarchal power against women. In fact, It may do some of this unaware, but it has some other agendas, and some of those agendas had to do with small colonized people who had been slaves in Egypt and marginalized by great landowners trying to image God in ways that liberate them. So I would see that, in fact, there's a different social agenda that underlies a whole other aspect of biblical language. And that, in fact, reflects a liberating social agenda. Let me just finish with a note about Mary Daly. Although she's into deconstructionists and alienated from Catholicism, in fact, much of her language still has remnants of the Thomistic theology she's trained in. Because that was really her training, and so she's constantly, in all kinds of funny ways, Thomistic language comes in. She talks about God as pure act, which is straight from Thomism. And the final cause, and all kinds of language. And one of my friends likes to refer to this aspect of Mary Daly as peeping Thomism.